KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Robert Horton will be here. Vaughn Palmer will be here. We're going to talk about Korea. We're going to hear from Taj Mahal. We're going to hear from Steven Pinker. We're going to run the gamut of ways to titillate your brain. But we are hoping, we are praying, we are...
Maggie?
I was going to say demanding, but I know some people will find that harsh. Demanding that you join your colleagues who have already pledged their support to this radio station, that is theirs, and help us reach our goal, $13,000 by the end of weekday, $950,000 to keep this radio station up and running and moving forward, 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. You can see the boxes in your mind. You can see the chart as it moves across the cardboard. And it's all pointing at you. You're the little stick figure at the end, and it says, you must call, because we're talking to you.
That's right, we're talking to you. 206-543-9595. 184,500 to go to finish the drive. That's what we're chipping away at. So
leave us chip away a little more rapidly.
Yes.
Leave us to carve the David of a pledge drive with your support.
206-543-9595. That's a pretty graphic image. I like that.
Well, think about it. We start this pledge drive just like a sculptor with an unformed block. And by the end of it, something emerges. Leave us to hope it is a beautiful success. Leave us to hope it is worthy of moving forward and putting in the statue of our pledge drives. You've seen the statuary room where all the pledge drives do end up.
I'll tell you, fall is gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Fall was gorgeous.
Some of the calls you made, the quality of your calls,
the on-air comments,
remarkable.
Amazing.
I think you can match that, you spring folks, you folks that are working. You're probably working in a hard wood at this point. But we are hoping you're working to call right now at 206-543-9595.
Or a toll-free 1-866-NPR-KUOW, 1-866-677-5869. You can also go online, KUOW.org. You can go online.
Did
I stop abruptly?
Yes.
Sorry. Lynn Bashan pledged in memory of her young neighbor, Ryan, from Maury Island. You can pledge in memory of people. You can pledge in honor of people. You can pledge in honor of your animals. You can pledge to do a chip in the David of this pledge drive that we're creating.
You know, think of yourself as an artist helping to create the public radio world. And you are Michelangelo. Maybe you're Picasso. Maybe you're Marc Chagall. There are any number of artistic approaches we take to public radio. And we hope you will take an artistic approach to pledging your support. The most important approach is the simplest one. Phone in hand, 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. You're a painter. You're adding the brushstroke of support to this fine public radio service. Enough metaphors for you, then I go back to the charts. $950,000. We need to raise another
$184,500.
You can help us get there by pledging just $250. We're not asking for the whole $950,000. We're just saying, what's it worth to you? You've been listening. You know how the pledge drive works. And now we're saying, well, Bob, well, Carol, well, person in a cubicle, well, fellow in a truck. What do you think? Do you think it's worth $150 a year? 206-543-9595. Give us a call.
Support for KUOW comes from the Champion Window and Sunroom Company.
KUOW would like to acknowledge the businesses that have donated food and beverages throughout our pledge drive, especially Stumptown Coffee Roasters, Top Pot Donuts, and the Bagel Deli. Thank you for supporting KUOW.
Support for NPR comes from Carbonite, automatic and encrypted cloud backup solutions that provide access to backed up files from any device. Carbonite.com.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts, presenting Bat Boy the Musical, a comedy about a half-boy, half-bat, based on the classic tabloid story in the Weekly World News. On stage April 10th through 13th at Cornish Playhouse at Seattle Center. Tickets and information at cornish.edu/events.
I think they're very provocative actions and belligerent tone. It has ratcheted up the danger.
It's a big stage, and it come on and you do your thing, and then it's time to take your bow, you know.
Thinking consists of having one pattern after another in a way that mirrors some kind of logic or statistical inference, so that you're not just having thoughts, but the thoughts actually allow you to deduce things or make predictions.
That's Steven Pinker talking about how your brain works. Also the great Taj Mahal and Chuck Hagel on North Korea. You know, nothing like getting you to pledge your support to public radio than the threat of a nuclear war. We may not be here next week. How about that for a pitch? South Korea's foreign minister warns that a medium-range missile test by the North Korean government could come at any time. We've been hearing that all morning on the newscast. Yesterday, the head of the U.S. Pacific Command told the Senate the tensions on the North Korean peninsula are at their highest point in 60 years. A lot of attention is focused on decoding the motivations of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Are these threats different from past saber rattlings by North Korea? Clark Sorensen chairs the Korea Studies Program at the University of Washington Jackson School of International Studies. Professor Sorensen, thanks for talking to us.
Glad to be here.
Well, let me start with that big question. Are these threats different in tone or even threat from past saber rattlings by North Korea?
They're shriller than normal. We're used to these kinds of bluster from North Korea, but to my knowledge, this is the first time they've specifically threatened us with thermonuclear war.
So all the commentators I read are saying, well, he's young, he doesn't have anything behind him, really, so he's got to be more blustery. But doesn't he have a whole history and a whole coterie of old generals who have been there for years and years?
Right. We don't know which generals are supporting him. He's purged some generals last year, so now he's got his own group in there. So I think he's consolidated his power. But exactly what he's doing is hard to know.
Wait, you're the Korea expert. That's why we called you.
Well, I don't have a phone line to Pyongyang, so I can't just call him up and ask him what's on his mind.
Well, see what Dennis Rodman thinks. You might figure it out.
Yeah, he might have some good insights.
Well, a lot of what we understand about North Korea is a way of understanding how China views North Korea. So what have you seen in China's actions over the past few days that give you some sense of what's unfolding?
Well, China is hard to decipher, too. On the one hand, the Chinese blogosphere, a lot of the ordinary Chinese people are fed up with North Korea. There was an article by a guy named Dong Yuan, who was a party journalist who wrote an article in London's Financial Times saying China should abandon North Korea. So these are new movements. But, you know, China moves very cautiously, and it's easy to overinterpret these kinds of things. I think China's alliance with North Korea is based on very entrenched thinking in the Chinese military, that they think they need a buffer state between Japan and the United States and themselves. And so even though there's new talk about abandoning North Korea, I don't really expect China to change that much in the short run.
So do you feel, when you look at the way the politics are currently playing out in North Korea, China, and South Korea, let's leave it to those three first. Are they back in the paradigm of the 1950s and 1960s?
No, it's not really the Cold War, because South Korea and China are avid trade partners. China is South Korea's largest trade partner and the bulwark of their economy. So relations between China and South Korea are actually kind of good. China and South Korea, even at the military level, have relations now. So that kind of thing has really changed dramatically since the 1960s. What hasn't changed is China's Cold War alliance with North Korea. And initially they called it an alliance of blood because North Korea supported China during the communists during the Chinese Civil War. It's not well known, but in 1947, a lot of the communists in Manchuria were allowed to hide in North Korea when the nationalists were coming after them. And so the Chinese Communist Party has always felt it has a debt of blood, as they call it, to North Korea. and they paid that debt back during the Korean War. So within party circles in China and within the Chinese military, there's really entrenched thinking that that North Korea is an ally that cannot be abandoned. A lot of that was based on personal contacts that people had in the late 40s and early 50s. Most of those people have died off or are very aged now, though. So the personal basis on which this has been maintained may very well be changing.
Clark Sorensen chairs the Korea Studies Program at the UW-Jackson School of International Studies. They're saying that a medium-range missile test by North Korea could come at any time. South Korea's foreign minister warned that. What you have a sense of what step along the way towards more concern that missile test would have in South Korea?
You know, people aren't too concerned. It's always prudent to be prepared. And if your goal is deterrence, which is what we say our goal is, then being well prepared is how you make deterrence effective. So we've had to respond. We've got our Aegis destroyers in the vicinity. We've said that we would shoot it down if it looks like it's aimed at the U.S. or Korea or Japan or our facilities. So there's no real danger, but we have had to mobilize our civil defense. I just got a report that on Guam they've mobilized their civil defense center because Guam is just barely within the range, supposedly, of these missiles. So we have to respond, although probably nothing is going to happen, because if the North Koreans want to survive, they can't precipitate war. They can't defeat even South Korea, much less South Korea backed by the U.S.
Do they expect China will back them with the full weight of their military if they do throw a missile out there?
You know, China has been playing kind of a wait-and-see game. What they really want is everything to be quiet in Northeast Asia so that they can develop without security concerns. And North Korea's activities make it difficult for them to do that. So China is seriously annoyed. They try to get North Korea to tone down the rhetoric, but North Korea only listens to China when it wants to. So China has to make a decision. On the one hand, they supported the UN sanctions that the United States put through the Security Council, and probably they'll follow those sanctions, although China's regime has been kind of a sieve. A lot of stuff gets through anyway. But China has to decide if they really put the squeeze on North Korea, North Korea might collapse. And China has never wanted that to happen in recent years. And so abandoning North Korea really means they have to face the possibility that North Korea might collapse, and they'd have to deal with that. And so I don't think they're going to go to that extent yet.
You know, some people say that this is about an internal power play, Kim Jong-un trying to establish his legitimacy against some factions that maybe think he's not as legitimate, and that this is a media campaign to talk to North Koreans. But John Stewart made a joke, which I just am wondering about. The North Koreans, they're not all that plugged into the international media. So wouldn't he be better, Kim Jong-un, just like going door to door and telling people, here I am? You know what I mean? I mean, who's he actually talking to?
Well, I think you're right that he's talking to a domestic audience to a large degree. I'm not sure he's trying to prove he's a great military leader, but I think the North Korean authorities think that they need outside pressure in order to justify their rule. So they ratchet up the pressure periodically and then claim a glorious victory, and that consolidates their rule in North Korea. I don't know that there's really anybody in North Korea that can oppose Kim Jong-un, so I'm not sure that he lacks legitimacy. Any more than the entire regime lacks legitimacy. But certainly ratcheting up the pressure, putting on a good show, getting people to march around Pyongyang is all part of the theater that creates the North Korean state.
I see. So the marching and the being on alert, that does affect, and that is for domestic consumption.
Yeah, not just for domestic consumption, but surely domestic consumption is an important aspect of it.
Is it to scare us a little bit, just enough so that we're still paying attention?
Yeah, they want us to pay attention. That's the other part. It's kind of like, hey, we're still here. You can't ignore us. We're a real threat. You better do something.
You know, you've had field work in Korea and in Asia. I was wondering, do you have friends there that you're in touch with?
Yeah. I have friends in Korea all the time.
What are you hearing from them? Are you concerned for them? Are you worried for them?
Not really. If I were scheduled to go to Korea this morning, I'd get on the plane and not give it a second thought. And I'm going to go to Korea this summer, and I haven't rescheduled that. There are a few nervous Nellies amongst the expats in South Korea that are wondering if they ought to get out of Seoul or something. But in general, people take it in stride. On the one hand, you do have to take them seriously. And so civil defense drills and so forth are part of how you have to respond. But on the other hand, North Korea can't really afford to precipitate a war because it's going to lose if it does.
Thank you, Professor Sorensen. I appreciate you talking to us this morning.
Okay. Great to be on.
Thank you. Clark Sorensen chairs the Korea Studies Program at the UW-Jackson School of International Studies. This is Weekday. Listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle. We had to stop our goofiness and frivolity and have a serious conversation with Professor Sorensen about what is happening in Korea. And yes, we are basically serious, buttoned down, staid people. I come in every day in a charcoal suit and some black suede shoes. And Katie Sewell is always in a very, very long dress.
Black.
Black, yes.
Black or gray.
We only let our hair down, so to speak, when the pledge drive comes around. And even then, you know, really, are we letting our hair down? I'm just swinging around in a chair. Our number is 206-543-9595. You listen to this program because you expect that we shut the heck up and let the people who know something talk, like Professor Sorensen. We're going to hear from Taj Mahal in a little bit and Steven Pinker, the scientist. Some best of, some big hits. But right now we're asking you to show your support. You painters, you sculptors, you creators of community, at 206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. I was going to just start doing Carl Sandburg, you hog butchers, you big-shouldered people of the world. Join us for support of this public radio service.
I like the idea of the big-shouldered people of the world coming together.
Yeah.
Joining us, 206-543-9595. I like this mention here. Sarah says she pledged because she remembered that when her and her six-year-old daughter were in a rental car headed to Austin, Texas, her daughter surprised her when she recognized Robert Siegel's voice and said to her, "Hey, he's in Seattle, too." That's good. That's good. I mean, it is partly about creating this for the next generation, right? We've talked about that a little bit. A listener mentioned, which I thought was so clever, that the way you know when you should pledge is when you start thinking that maybe you should pledge. Like,
yeah.
You start getting into that debate, like, maybe it's me that
maybe
you're talking
me
to.
Maybe it's me, yeah.
Well, you know, I do really like public radio. And he said the moment you even think that maybe it's possible that you should pledge, so you should just stop putting it off and go pledge.
Because you are the reason we're here. We're here because you're interested in these conversations. You know that you're going to be talking about them later, and you know basically you're here to learn. A hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. That's Carl Sandburg, Chicago. I think we could probably turn that into a pledge drive, but many of you who believe Carl Sandburg should not be doggerled, I won't do that. But I remind you that only on public radio would we be talking about you showing your support to this service by conjuring up Carl Sandburg's vision of Chicago. 206-543-9595.
Or toll-free 1-866-NPR-KUOW. 1-866-677-5869. And really, where else on the radio dial do you even hear poetry? or, you know, fine literature, or discussions about, you know, these historical figures, or where you would even hear a mention of the Statue of David.
Yes.
Public radio really is the only place where these kinds of things are talked about. It's a it's an outlier.
Well, I do hear it on the, is it KZOK? Who's the guy I like so much who does the songs? He's had songs for a long time, and he has his morning zoo with all his other folks. And
well, there's a lot of different
know,
people who have done that, Steve.
On KZOK. I can't remember his name, but he's great. He would probably throw down Carl Sandburg right there, and I'm going to remember his name in a moment. But in the meantime, we need you to call 206-543-9595. Why do you listen to public radio? Why do you care about public radio? Because we run the gamut. We run the gamut from Korea to eating.
And to eating, yes. We have a limited thank you gift. They call them thank you gifts. I call them prizes. $120 level. Get a subscription to Edible Magazine. Get some prizes today. Give us a call. 206.
Get some prizes.
206-543-9595. You know, sometimes you just don't have anything good to read. This is a free magazine subscription at your pledge of $120. We've got 10 of those if that interests you. 206-543-9595. If it doesn't, we've got T-shirts, we've got mugs,
we've got prizes.
We've got headphones, we've got all sorts of stuff. There are prizes online, kyow.org. It's up to you.
It's nice to get a prize for doing something that you know you should do anyways.
Think of it as a gold star.
You're happy to do. Very nice. It is a gold star. These Edible Seattle subscriptions at $120, that's a gold star for you. For him to do that. Taj Mahal, two-time Grammy-winning musician, multiple award-winning musician, composer, vocalist. He's influenced and been influenced by American blues and roots for the past half century. Because you listened at weekday, because you are a supporter of public radio, you know he's been our guest a few times, and we just wanted to listen to him again. You were talking about prizes and gold stars, Katie Sewell. One of the prizes and the gold stars we give you, but in truth we give ourselves to is to hear these guy. It just was great to talk to Taj Mahal. I will admit that he is one of my musical heroes. So he came in, he was talking about his work, he was at Jazz Alley, he was talking about 50 years in music. His latest release is Maestro, celebrating 40 years. It's a celebration of his great musical career. I say 50 because for a long time he just played in his house, and his mom and his dad encouraged him to play. And he talked about those early years in the blues music scene in America.
The industry was unable to handle black musicians and white musicians working together in front of a white audience. They just couldn't handle it.
Didn't even know how to think about it.
They couldn't handle it, you know, and they didn't. And a lot of incredible bands, black rock bands, mixed bands from Mexican and black, you know, European American and black, you know, African American, they just got left by the wayside. I mean,
you guys, right? Rising Sons?
Rising Sons was the same thing, you know. I mean, what they do is they decommission you by signing you. You know, and then you think something's really happened, but you know, that's all the negative. What that did was drive me to do the stuff that I did, that I wanted to hear. Because I mean, you know, if you really study what's going on with the music, and I'm not talking about notes, I'm just talking about the history of the music and the history of the music business and all who was pulling the strings behind it, and the gangsters and the management and the agents and the syndicate, all the stuff, you know, that made the scene, that set the scene for rock and roll. Right now, there's a great book out called The Chitlin' Circuit by this guy named Lauterbach. And that, The Chitlin' Circuit, is just phenomenal because it shows you what was the road that set up from rock and roll. I don't know what his first name is, but Lauterbach. Lauterbach.
You know, Buddy Guy was here.
Oh, yeah, Buddy. Good people.
And, yeah. And he was talking about that decision he made and the people he encountered once he got to Chicago and how it was, who was it in the back of his car that said, keep doing this, gave him some chicken and some beans that he had picked up but he hadn't eaten in a while, said, keep doing this, but you're going to be fighting a lot of people.
Yeah.
Buddy Guy talked about in his biography, talked about these clubs, though they changed in the mid to late 60s. Early 60s, the clubs in Chicago where he was talking about especially were just vibrant.
Yeah.
Just full of people.
Teresa's,
out dancing.
Mother Blues.
Yeah. Did you?
Silvio.
Did you go to some of those clubs?
I went to hear music there, yeah. I didn't get to play them because it was, they were really, they really looked out for the guys from Chicago, so.
And there was a hierarchy, too.
Yeah. Well, I could play, but it wasn't the issue. But that was their scene. But as that scene dried up, had those guys had started realizing, see, they left out of there and went down to the Chitlin circuit and then went back to Chicago. And then if they were lucky enough, if somebody from the outside, particularly the English groups, got excited about them, then their name would get out and get in amongst all these young kids, and then their records would be sought after. There's always the blues mafia, and blues Nazis are out there always trying to decide, what they know is more better than, the development of the music. The music was developing along pretty daggone good until all these people got in there and started messing with it. And then, next thing you know, it's just constipated on itself. It can't go nowhere. I'm serious. It's the truth. Well, what happens? Look at rap, man. 30 years. The first 10 or 15 years of rap, car would pull past you and your hair would stand up on edge. Go like, did I just hear that? And it was an affront to your senses. Now, I don't care how loud they play it. It's all computerized drivel.
But you hear it. Different sounds emerging in different places that are,
that's
what's so interesting.
Outside, yeah. Once you understand that people outside don't have to, pander to whatever the standard is here. I mean, to me, the best, you asked me, you were saying something about where music is going. The best thing that happened to music recently was rap. And like bebop. Like blues, like jazz, those are all outlaw musics. Even gospel was an outlaw music.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, because the designer of gospel is one Thomas A. Dorsey, who used to be known as Georgia Tom, the blues singer, and so he and people like Sister Rosetta Thorpe, who was really a gospel, a disseminator of gospel all over the place. And she worked back and forth with, like, Andy Kirk and Lucky Millinder's band. And, I don't know if you've ever spent any time looking at her on YouTube. Oh, seriously.
Look her up.
Oh, my God. It's like you talk about somebody that Elvis Presley was excited by. Everybody talks about, Arthur Big Boy Crudup. But he and lots of the early rockers were nuts about Rosetta Thorpe. Rosetta Thorpe was a serious guitar player. She started out playing like a national duolian, and then she played some sort of Gibson, solid body Gibson. And we're talking about play. We're not talking about jang-a-langa, jang-a-langa. Notes playing with a jazz band. Kill on it. And she, but this people that were doing that, the religious community was like, they're not having no blues notes in no Christian music. And it took a while. Now we're looking back and nobody thinks of it. People don't think of blues as being a radical music. And then early rap, now it's like it's already happened. But when it was coming down the pike, it was like bebop. It was radical, and it shook people up. And, it was a point of view. I mean, if you really see where these kids were, is that who helped them get the instruments? Nobody. They shut down all the music in the community? The only way they could learn the music was off of the records that they heard. So, you know, here you got the music which is happening in its natural form or as natural as it can be, and then it gets recorded, and then from the recordings it comes into the people, and then these kids are younger and they hear that, and then that's what they go back to. They don't go back to traditional rhythms or anything that's structured like that. Plus, aside from that, was that by that time, everybody was into, like, Luther Vandross. And, you know, Luther had everybody, had, you know, the women mesmerized. And the young kids coming up, they wanted something hard. That's why I Walked This Way got up in there, you know, because it was like, yeah, some edge to it. But if you ultimately think about it, where does those guys come? They're playing rock. Where does rock go back to? Blues. You know, where does the blues go back to? It's the same thing.
I was always struck by how interesting it was that in the 70s, those guys were using, they were making their technology. They're creating the turntables that would work. They were figuring out with masking tape and arms how they could make music.
Yeah.
I just thought that was...
But that's the mother of necessity. You know, that's the mother of invention. You know, and necessity is the mother of invention. And it's like, what you going to do? You know, nobody's paying no attention to what you're doing. You know, so you have need a block party, climb up a pole, hook up, just the same way that Jamaica. And it was a lot apart from the Caribbean people, particularly the Jamaicans, you know, who used to have big sound systems down in the... And when they moved up in it, because I met half my family, my stepfather from the time I was like 13, 14 years old, is Jamaican. So I grew up in that. And my own father was from St. Kitts and Nevis till he passed. You know, so I was inside of both a Southern and a Caribbean harmonic. I'm a harmonic in that thing.
When did you take over your own, you know, control of your music?
I got control of music from the beginning.
Well, I mean in terms of selling it, distributing it. Having to rely on a record company to figure out something.
Yeah, well, I would get stuff. I would buy music in bulk from them and sell it on my own. I mean, all of it. See, what happened? What the great divide for me was, I was with the Rising Suns. All the musicians were signed. Okay, that band, because of politics and everything else, just started to implode. Everybody said, look, let's get out of this before we lose our positivity toward each other as friends. So people made a move. While I was still on the label, I called up Clive Davis. I spoke with Clive Davis. Clive Davis sent out to me. We had a conversation, a long, good, nice conversation. And he sent David Rubinson out to me. I said, here's one of our company staff producers. If you like him, you know, we'll see what we can do. If you don't, we'll try something. Came out, David was perfect. Because what David did exactly what Damon Dash did for Jay-Z. He did the business, and I did the music. He left me alone from all the way from the beginning. So all the music that I was used to playing was exactly what was in my head, no matter what the record company was about with other people. Yeah, you can sit in all those meetings, and you can do this, and you can do that, and your music still sounds like it's dead, and this is not dead music. And so I would rather have the music live so that you listen to it, so that listening to it from this point in my life, I did what I wanted to do.
But we're not talking about legacy, right? Because the music always moves on.
When you get called to be a musician, it's not, you know, you saw somebody on the stage and you obsessed on the fact that they had something that you didn't have at that moment. Therefore, you wanted it and you went after that. It's a deeper calling than that. It's ancient. And when you get called, like I was called as a young child, listen to it. Not only listening to it, but in the dream space, which I didn't even, wasn't until the 60s and I started being able to understand what was actually happening, what the transference of the energy from your ancestors through your DNA, you know, and all that kind of stuff like that, which is esoteric, you know,
But real?
But very real, you know, and anyway, so... It's a big stage, and you come on and you do your thing, and then it's time to take your bow. You know,
last year you were here. You played some music with your trio. We'll go out with a little bit of that. Kester Smith, Bill Rich, Taj Mahal. Thank you, sir.
All right, my pleasure.
song. Try living by yourself. Mean old world. Try living by yourself. When the wine you've been loving.
That is Taj Mahal Trio, Kester Smith on drums, Bill Rich bass, recorded live at KUOW in 2011. Taj Mahal was with us just this last year talking about his career. I love that interview. If you haven't heard that whole interview, you get the entire history of American music with Taj Mahal. It's such a, I just remember listening to it and being glad that I could listen to it and that we all could listen to it. And it's online because people have paid for the support of this radio station to put our archives online. So there's a little prize, a little gold star for all of us to enjoy in the midst of the pledge drive. And it's a thank you to Taj Mahal and Jazz Alley and to you for being a supporter of public radio. And so those of you who have not become supporters of public radio, get that gold star, as Katie Sewell put it. She will come to your house and put the gold star on your kitchen.
Ding!
206-543-9595, 1-866-677-5869. Probably have to be a fairly substantial pledge for her to come, but perhaps not. I don't know. She might come for $120. She might for $575. It's really up to you.
It depends on how much work we have to do that week, I suppose.
The gold star, the virtual gold star comes when you pledge your support. You feel better. You know, as you were saying, Katie Sewell, you know, when, as soon as you start thinking, boy, are they talking to me? Well, then yes, you know we are talking to you, and we're looking for your support. Three Edible Seattle subscriptions left only.
$120 level, $120.
You get a subscription to Edible Seattle, and you get that gold star. You can look at the Edible Seattle as the little gold star that'll be sitting on your coffee room table.
It's the prize. 206-543-9595. Yeah, the moment you start to contemplate pledging your support to KUOW, just do it. 206-543-9595. You know, it's rainy outside today. It's depressing, and it's like the whole world is weeping. But perhaps we could say, instead of it crying for the fact that, you know, you haven't yet called, which it might be. Nature might be on our side here. Perhaps we can say it's washing the slate clean. If you haven't called, it's all forgiven. It's all forgiven. But now we're counting on you to, you know, think about it and actually give us a ring.
Slate is clean.
Slate is clean. Hey, nice. You delayed. You pondered. It's been 10 years of constant listening. You've never pledged your support. Hey, slate is clean. Just give us a call. 206-543-9595. Toll free. 1-866-NPR-KYW.
You know, I just took a little walk down to the statuary of past public pledge drives. And there are some amazing, amazing creations that have been made over the years as people have pledged their support and carved out the edifices, the statuary, the beautiful arms and legs that are curved in marble that is public radio. We're just waiting for you to chip away at it with us. You know you're ready. You've got that chisel in hand. 206-543-9595. Potters, you will probably want some pot-throwing metaphors. I can do that. Painters, painting metaphors. Jewelers, glassblowers, metalsmiths, truck drivers, any metaphor you like. If you've thought about it, the most important thing is it's you, and it's time for you to call.
206-543-9595. One gold prize of getting Edible Seattle at the $120 left. That's just a prize. We like to reward you for giving your support to this station, but we also you don't need prizes. It's a prize in your heart. The rain is wiping the slate clean. It's waiting for you to call. Maybe it'll get sunny after you call. Wouldn't that be a miracle?
I like that idea.
543-9595.
I rode my bike in this morning, and I forgot to put my rain pants on because I was not being very clever.
Well, that explains a lot.
And I've been soaking wet. But now I'm becoming clean with the hope of public radio and your support. 206-543-9595. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at WashingtonEnergy.com.
KUOW and Bremerton Community Theater present Urinetown, the musical. In this satirical comedy, a severe water shortage results in harsh laws regulating restroom use, and violators are exiled to the penal colony Urinetown, April 5th through May 5th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Art Museum, presenting Rembrandt Van Dyck Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, London, featuring a collection of European masterpieces. Museum open Tuesday through Sunday. Tickets and information at seattleartmuseum.org.
Well, we have piqued your brain this hour, your international focus this hour, your commitment and connection to the world this hour with conversation on North Korea. We rumbled your artistic soul, the conversation with the great Taj Mahal. Now we pique your brain, the actual thing itself, the stuff inside, with Harvard professor Steven Pinker. The stuff of thoughts. Language is a window into human nature. In that book, he explains what we can learn about human nature through the lens of language. He's an experimental psychologist. His research has focused on language and cognition. We talk with him about how our brain frames words and information. You get where we're going, right? Framing things, getting you to think about how you're committed to public radio. But that's not what we talked about then. We talked about just at the beginning, I asked him, how does the brain work?
The brain does lots of things. It metabolizes fats and gives off heat. But the thing that it does that makes us smart is the cells fire in patterns. That is a particular, it's not like you have one brain cell per thought, but rather ensembles of cells, hundreds of thousands, fire in a pattern. One pattern triggers another pattern. Learning consists of modifying the strengths of the connections between the brain cells so that the patterns get stamped into memory. Thinking consists of having one pattern after another in a way that mirrors some kind of logic or statistical inference so that you're not just having thoughts, but the thoughts actually allow you to deduce things or make predictions.
Much of the first part of this book was about basically about verbs and about how the concepts work with different verbs and don't work with different verbs. And how is that related back to this notion of brain cells firing in patterns?
Well, the question is what are the patterns correspond to? What's the alphabet of our thoughts that go into all of the wonderful complex things that we're able to reason and argue about? And for me, verbs were an entry point. Nouns typically label things, but verbs capture relationships among things, events, cause and effect, goals and intentions. So verbs are the units of thought that make us able to reason and think in complex ways. Just to be concrete, I mean, this is a problem that I started with many years ago, way before I wrote this book, but something that I worried about. I had to figure out how kids acquire their first language. One of the things they have to acquire is how to build sentences around verbs. A verb is kind of like a chassis of a sentence. It's got slots for the subject and the object and the prepositional objects that get bolted on. So to be able to utter a sentence, you need to know how the verbs work. And here's a little puzzle. How come you can say, I poured water into the glass, but if you said, I poured the glass with water, you know what that means, but somehow that sounds a little odd. But then the verb fill goes the other way around. You can fill the glass with water, but to fill some water into the glass sounds a little bit odd. Again, you know what it means. Are these just quirks, like irregular verbs that you just have to memorize? Well, it turns out probably not, that each one involves a different way of thinking about the event, focusing on some things, ignoring others, a different way of framing the event. Pouring water into the glass is doing something to the water, namely causing it to move, to go into the glass. Filling the glass with water is doing something to the glass, not the water, that is causing it to change state from empty to full. So it's the same event. Water molecules end up in the glass, but you can have two different mindsets, doing something to the water in physical space, doing something to the glass in terms of its state. And if a simple and concrete an event as getting yourself a glass of water to drink can be framed in two incompatible ways, each with its own verb, it shows, first of all, that one thing the human mind is in the habit of doing is not just registering reality as a kind of copy, but rather always framing situations in one or another way, that a lot of our debates and discourse and puzzles consist of arguing among frames. Did we invade Iraq or did we liberate Iraq? Is stem cell research studying destroying a blastocyst or a human life? A lot of our debates consist of taking the same state of affairs in the world, but framing them in different ways. And even in an itty-bitty verb like pour and fill, you get that choice of frame.
I think somewhere in the book, you turned George Lakoff.
Yeah.
Did you turn him into a verb, or would that be an adjective?
I think I turned him. I did talk about Lakoffian.
Lakoffian.
Yes, yeah. I made him an adjective. Yeah.
The notion, he's somebody who writes about framing as well in political terms, as, among other places. In that, these arguments among frames, rather than people. These arguments among frames are things that can be then unpacked, and we can see, I mean, do we get beyond, for example, stem cell? I mean, is that the fundamental unit? It's either killing an embryo. Yeah,
ball of cells versus human life.
I mean, is that the bottom unit when we're looking at the reframes?
No. See, and this is where I have a huge amount of admiration for Lakoff's work in linguistics on the ubiquity of metaphor in ordinary conversation that we don't even realize. I think he takes the argument too far when it comes to framing in politics, because he's had a second career as a political consultant and guru.
For the Democrats.
For the Democrats. But the idea that and while I completely agree that framing is the essence of argument and debate in all fields, I think he has a view of people as kind of zombies or dogs being conditioned in the harness, where all you need to do is change the frame and repeat the frame, and people's minds will be changed. And that leads to what I consider dubious proposals, like the Democrats should reframe taxes as membership fees to make them more palatable. I think this is an idea that's going to go nowhere. And the reason is that, yes, we do frame, we do understand reality by a particular conceptualization, a particular framing, but we can get beneath the frame. We can criticize frames. We can analyze them. We can evaluate their aptness or their fidelity or their truthfulness. We can do it indirectly through satire, as on political comedy shows, or we can do it through debate. Is the Iraq escapade an invasion or a liberation? Well, that very much depends on whether the Iraqis welcomed us or resented us. And it's a question that could be answered by asking them, or at least different sectors of the population. Is stem cell research something that destroys a ball of cells or a human life? Well, you can ask, what is it about human life that deems it worthy of protection, such as consciousness, the actual interests of the person? And one could say, well, before the brain exists, the brain being the seat of consciousness and feeling, we don't deserve to confer, aren't compelled to confer protection on the ball of cells. Someone from the other side could then say, no, once you shift the line after conception, you get a slippery slope, etc. I mean, the debate can happen. It's not just I yell ball of cells, ball of cells, ball of cells. You say human life, human life, human life, and whoever shouts the loudest and most often wins. I think I therefore have a more optimistic view of the potential for human rationality.
Steven Pinker is author of The Stuff of Thought: Language is a Window into Human Nature. You said truthfulness there. Does understanding framing, does understanding how the brain arrives at the different notions of pour and fill get us to a notion of truthfulness?
Well, that gets us, I think, to a notion of what are the units of thought. Like in the case of pour versus fill, cause, move, go, place, and that's what's used in POR, change, state, goal, that's involved in fill. And so you can kind of dismantle the verb or dissect the verb in order to find the fine structure of thinking. In terms of getting it to actually be true or false, I think we have a lot of social institutions like science and journalism that refine our own tendency to often not care about whether our ideas are true or false. I don't think people don't want to be in a state of hallucination. They don't want to be out of touch with reality. But there are a lot of parts of our nature that don't align our beliefs with the truth. I mean, we want our truth to be accepted, not the truth to be accepted. And a lot of the tensions and difficulties in doing science or journalism or history consist of overriding people's individual tendency towards self-deception and towards advertising their beliefs as a kind of an ego trip, and to align our collective beliefs with reality as best we can.
Huh? What do you think about that argument? Katie Whoa. Sewell, that was Steven Pinker, John Stone, family professor of psychology at Harvard. He has won many awards for his teaching on language and cognition. 2004, he was ranked as one of the most influential people in the world. His latest one of his books, Stuff of Thought, Language is a Window into Human Nature.
Well, launching off what he was just talking about, we should ask the question, how do we reframe the pledge drive to make people change their minds and pledge?
All right.
If they're currently stoically against the idea.
Yes, because they're egoly engaged in their own reality, their own
They've created
facts.
Their own truth.
Yes.
They don't need to know the actual truth, that this drive won't end until you make the connection and call. 206-543-9595.
Muse on that, and we'll check for your answers in a moment.
And now, the sound of the day.
Ross writes, I spent the better part of two hours this weekend circling our house perimeter, trying to track down the varmint that was the source of this intermittent noise, only to realize that it was the zipper pull of my jacket tangling just under my chin.
That is a good one.
After trying to duplicate the sound later, I realized that it only occurs in temperatures lower than 50 degrees, making it a springtime sound in Seattle.
Oh, good one, Ross.
Oh,
good one.
So good.
I love the sound of the day.
What interesting sounds are you hearing? I hope you'll share them with us. Record 30 seconds. Send it to us along with the story behind it. And email it to weekday@kuow.org.
Those are hours he'll never get back.
The sound of the day in the subject. Oh, haven't we all done that? Oh, that's so good. All right. Reframing the pledge drive.
Let's reframe the pledge drive.
It is the sound you chase.
The sound you chase.
When you know it's just right there with you all the time. You're looking for what's of value. Oh, this is a good one. You're looking for what's of value, what's important. You know, and you're always looking out and out, and you realize, oh, you know what's of value, what's important? How I get informed is it's right here. It's right in the earbuds that I'm listening to this radio to. It's right in my car right now.
It's in every room of my house. That's good. Let me try. Oh, first I'll give the number, 206-543-9595. We want to blow our $13,000 goal out of the water. But let me try reframing it this way. Krista says, I love KUOW. I listen all the time in the car as I drive to work, and I enjoy spending the day with my intellectual friends on the radio. Can you please mention sometime how important it is to donate blood?
Wow, okay.
Thank you. And good luck with the drive. So maybe we could reframe it in the, we will mention what it is you want us to if you call the pledge room now and send a message through our pledge volunteers.
Oh, I see. I thought you were going for what Pinker was talking about with metaphor, how language and metaphor was so important, and yet it can get us a little...
Pure bribery.
Oh, pure bribery.
206-543-9595. You got a show coming up? Call it in. Pledge your support to KYW, and let me know what it is I should mention. 206-543-9595.
I don't think it really quite works like that, does it?
No, but it is another way to reframe the pledge drive.
Yeah, that's true.
You can also go online, kyw.org. A lot of people have sent us messages that way as well. And donate blood, for goodness sake.
And donate blood. There you go. And donate blood. 206-543-9595. We have an overall goal of $13,000 for weekday. We're halfway there. That's excellent. Thank you. But we have an even bigger goal. We are counting down. Now, you've made this promise now, Katie. We are counting down. We have $176,000 to go. Sound like a lot? Well, you know, the Mariners had a pretty small turnout last night at 10,000 people. If each of you, and my point being, there are many more than 10,000 of you who are listening, and many of you have not pledged. If each of you imagine yourself in Mariners Stadium right now and get the crowd a little bigger than that very small turnout, if each of you pledge 100.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.